What's up with Jessup? It's the only way to wake up. We state our views, state facts, and then afterwards we make up. From politics, business, to lifestyle, let's get this. Jessup Jong knows all the facts. He has no missed list. This podcast is your place for breaking news and hot takes. It's the only way to wake up. What's up with Jessup?
Welcome to What's Up with Jessup. We're joined here with Kurt Long. He was an Atchison Fellow of Public Service at Johns Hopkins University with me.
Yes, they kicked me out of the program, though, unfortunately.
Did I kick you out of the program? maybe we could have. We were in trouble, and we might have kicked each other out.
Yes, yeah. There was a lot of politics.
There was a lot of politics. Naturally, because people we were with were studying politics, interested in that. Maybe it makes sense for them to be interested in politics.
And according to Samuel P. Huntington, our cultural differences with them necessitate we would come into conflict. I think that's something along the lines of.
Okay.
I think this has to be edited out. That definitely has to be.
Well, first of all, we're not editing. Okay. But what you were referring to was this clash of civilization, where, you know, this is a political science, you know, literature that's legitimate, and he talks about how different religions, different cultures clash with each other, and that it is almost inevitable for these kind of cultures, religions to conflict.
Yeah.
Is that a good summarization? Do you have anything else to add about the idea?
Yes, that's one theory for sort of international conflict, and like explain international conflict and the formation of like different alliances, and I think it was most notably used as to explain the sort of alliance system that came into being after the breakup of Yugoslavia.
Huh. And how is that? How was the ally system really related to the clash of civilizations or different cultures?
Well, so Huntington wrote Clash of Civilizations in, it was an essay, I think an article in about 1989.
Uh-huh.
And then I think it's called the Serbian Civil War, the breakup of Yugoslavia.
Uh-huh.
Happened in the mid-90s.
Uh-huh.
And during the breakup of the war, basically different factions in Yugoslavia separated out based off of what appeared to be like a lot of different religious affiliations. So Catholics sort of allied themselves with Western countries like France. Orthodox Christians allied themselves with, Russia, and Muslim individuals sort of and groups sort of allied themselves with like Saudi Arabia, Turkey. That's kind of how things broke down, and people have used that to sort of justify, look, Huntington was right. You know, you can believe whatever you want about that, though. I'm sure there's probably counter arguments to that.
Of course.
Disagree with that.
Right. So what was Russia's religion, or people who, or I guess countries that allied with Russia? What was the religion?
Orthodox. Orthodox Christians.
Orthodox Christians.
Orthodox.
And then those with the Western countries was Catholic or Christian?
Yeah, Catholics. I don't know if there are a ton of Protestants in Yugoslavia, but I think I read that it was a lot of Catholics kind of allied them more with the West. Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. It's pretty crazy stuff.
Yeah. Crazy. I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean, if you're trying to, I guess, analyze what causes conflict and what's a factor that plays a big role in causing conflict, and Sammy Huntington, through his book, is arguing that religion and culture does.
Yes. Yes. Very very controversial opinion.
Right. Right.
Yeah. But yes, that is Huntington's argument.
Right. And I think I might be wrong, but there are also people like Francis Fukuyama, who wrote End of History, was arguing maybe the argument against Samuel Huntington and saying that, you know, there will be actually an end of history where these kinds of conflicts no longer arise, because liberal democracy, this ideology, will be able to unify all these countries without these divisions that you would normally see that Samuel Huntington describes, like religion and culture.
Yes. Yeah, that's great. That's a great analogy there.
Right.
That was, yes, Fukuyama's famed sort of end of history sort of makes that argument. And he traces it, to sort of the relative peace that we've seen.
Right.
Decades.
Yeah. And it's like safe to say that both authors really have gone back on their arguments. I mean, Francis Fukuyama has wrote another book and saying, you know, sorry guys, I was wrong. You know, there is still war. we might not be there yet. So
yes,
I'm sure there was some kind of version of that for Samuel Huntington as well.
Yeah, Huntington did change a lot of his, I think he did kind of change it, his thesis somewhat, with his 2004 book he released. Although it perhaps is only more controversial than it was. I've never read it. I don't know. I just read Washington Post article on this.
Right.
Well,
but it's it's what a lot of people call qualifying your argument, bringing more context to what you argued originally, or maybe going back on some of the points that you made, updating it. You know, it's a great business. The more books you write, the more reason for other people to read it.
yeah. That's a good point. Yeah, gaining knowledge is a process. And, there's nothing wrong with it. It takes a little while. Nothing wrong with that.
Exactly.
It takes a little bit.
Yeah, and profiting while you do that.
Well, yeah. exactly.
Yeah. You know, if you just want the real truth or the best version of the truth, you have to read all 2, 3 or all of the books that Samuel Huntington or Fukuyama wrote to really gain that essence.
Yeah, exactly. To really know what's going on. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
You have to read it all. And Trumps like us, who got tricked into majoring in political science, have to purchase these books. Which is
exactly
the greatest
I agree. That's what we do all day.
Yeah, I know.
We just continue buying books from these authors who are thinking about things differently, updating their opinions. We're buying all that and fueling that industry.
Yeah, exactly. We're encouraging them to change their opinions in some ways.
We are. We
by the fact that we keep buying. We have to keep buying.
Exactly. So I guess that's one productive way that we contribute to the economy, now that we know we won't be employed after graduation. At least we're fueling the economy and stimulating while we're in school.
Yeah, I know, right? It's great, because we will not be doing anything else.
Nothing productive economically.
As political science majors, certainly not adding a whole lot of productive.
What's the word?
Marginal economic utility. Ours is,
mm-hmm.
is
marginal utility is pretty, is it small?
Pretty low.
Yeah.
I think ours.
Exactly. That is probably how a lot of people see our major, you know, political science. Maybe it's barely even a science. It's just politics.
Yeah.
discussing it and buying a lot of books.
Scientists. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I agree.
Yeah. Now with the advent of internet, even you, all of your listeners, all of our listeners can be political scientists pretty much.
mm-hmm. Yeah. Pretty much anyone can. Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah. We're amidst the COVID-19 epidemic here where school has been transferred or transitioned into internet learning. I mean,
mm-hmm.
there is no much difference.
yeah.
Online learning. And,
yeah. yeah, no, at this point, I mean, you can just go on the internet, you can go on Apple Podcasts,
yeah.
Get incredible lectures
mm-hmm.
from top professors,
yeah.
On you know just about any subject.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I definitely recommend people listen to the Yale. I think there's a Yale political philosophy podcast.
No way.
Uh
huh.
Yeah, and it's just like a lecture.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really quite well done. It's very fun to listen to. People should also check out on YouTube Benjamin Ginsberg's lectures. Incredible.
Yeah. Why is that? Why should we check out Mr. Ginsberg?
He's just a genius.
He's a genius. There you go. You heard it here.
Ideas and incredible. Yeah.
He's incredible.
He's a great speaker.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. We've both taken classes by this professor that you mentioned, Professor Benjamin Ginsberg.
Benjamin Ginsberg, yes.
Is interested in a lot of issues in the Middle East and American politics, I assume.
He focuses on American politics.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
So what's an idea that you thought was really genius, that really persuaded you that this professor is a genius, a stable genius at that?
I love Dr. Ginsberg's idea of sort of like political freedom, and that
uh-huh.
it's as much it's not just about having the right to vote, but also having autonomy
mm-hmm.
from political actors.
Uh-huh.
Having a sphere of your life where you're
uh-huh.
not a member of some movement, you're not a member of a party or something like that, but you're your own person, you
mm-hmm.
do your own thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's we should look at that as true political freedom, not
right.
as not just as the right to vote.
Right.
I think
so you're telling me all these fancy words, but pretty much his argument is saying by voting, you get freedom from other political actors. So voting is your freedom, pretty much.
Well,
is that accurate?
Well,
what is he saying?
He kind of makes the argument that I think sometimes you shouldn't vote, or that I don't even, I'm not even going to, I'm going to misinterpret it. I probably
uh-huh. I mean, you've taken his classes a lot, so.
I have, yeah.
From the short time that you've
He's
been
a funny guy.
All of his classes, you're saying sometimes you shouldn't vote. And sometimes
he
should vote.
He says that sometimes he doesn't vote.
Uh-huh.
But,
as a political scientist, that's what he
yeah.
studies, and he sometimes does not vote.
Yeah.
And why is that?
Well, I think that's good. Well, it's like, I forget. He mentioned this in our class together, American Politics.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So you should remember this, Jess.
Mm.
I don't know why you don't.
Okay. Well, first of all, I don't think anyone really pays attention in his class. he starts talking about all these kinds of different fun stories about him being in Chicago.
He's got great
still
stories.
There. Yeah.
Oh my God, I love his stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was fun, but the point being is that, you know, you're saying voting is important. You can use that power.
Voting is important, but also not voting.
Exactly. So you can use that power to either vote or not vote. Wow.
So if anyone tries to give you, basically the point is, but if everyone tries to give you shit for not voting, you can say that you're expressing your political freedom by not voting.
Right. Right.
And that's...
Wow. Wow. Yeah. See, what I would imagine is that doesn't really take 4 years to learn. and 8 years to do a PhD. And, you know, 10, 20 years to become a professor. So that seems quite intuitive.
I disagree. I think it's fucking genius.
Okay.
I love it.
Fair enough. So, okay, we've learned that voting is important in politics.
or that it's not important. Also.
That it's not important. Or that it's important that you don't take it as important. Some metaphysical thing going on here.
I think we've completely misinterpreted ideas here.
Right, right. But no worries. I mean, it's almost like poetry, you know?
Was there
intention? Well, I don't know anything about poetry, but I'm going to go on a limb and saying, like, some people believe the poet's intention is important. It's also the context in which it is being interpreted that is important. Maybe we are in
That's
the latter right now.
I'll try and tell my professors that.
Of course, yeah. I mean, if a student who has taken your class for 4 years still does not get your thesis, I think you might be doing something wrong.
All right. This isn't like a main
no
thesis.
No calling names.
Joseph, I'm not going to let you belittle my...
You're right.
My wonderful professor.
You're right. I agree. Mm-hmm. And he's a genius.
Literally.
I agree.
His most famous book is, I think, it's kind of interesting. He writes on American politics mostly, but his most famous book is actually probably All of the Faculty, which is about... it's a polemic about how
so what is a polemic
university book? System basically changed. He takes a very strong stance on sort of the negative side effects of the sort of bureaucratization of universities.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Huh.
Universities have become.
Yeah.
They've got many more administrators. They've got many. Than they did in the past, and he kind of identifies that as a problem.
Yeah.
The university. Yeah.
That's fascinating. I mean, that's pretty similar to what we studied about in our semester at DC. The bureaucratization of universities.
That's true.
Huh.
That's
and
true.
So what does he say in his book about bureaucratization of universities?
He makes this argument that it's pretty much the same stuff that all the sort of price increases we've seen at universities. People attribute it to all these sort of different factors, increased competition between universities. They have to spend more money on buildings and stuff.
Yeah.
In order to attract essentially like customers or students.
Yeah.
But that's actually probably, that's really not the reason. And I think this also, we saw this in the data that we looked at in the Aitchison class. That probably really isn't the reason. It's actually has much more to do with the sort of heavy administrative bloat that has sort of taken place. Universities, you know, are, you know, essentially like kind of, sort of similar to government agencies in that they don't really have exactly like profits. They're not really under the same pressures as, you know, private businesses to sort of you know, reduce expenditures. So, they can often end up with a lot of administrative bloat, and that's made them expensive. That's one problem.
But, that's a great point. So because they're not a for-profit kind of company, they can have a bloating effect of the administration of people who are not actually needed or not really useful for the end, I guess, bottom line financially, but they still exist.
That's
interesting. I mean, we read the book Paying for the Party by, I think, Laura Hamilton, where the university is really set up to serve the affluent family. So this is maybe like a argument right against that. It's similar to what we did with Fukuyama and Hamilton, where, you know, this is...
That was a interesting book, actually.
Right?
What was the... why don't you talk a little bit about that? That's a good, a good one,
Sure. So it's called the party pathway, right? So affluent kids, they don't really need to go to college. it's really the idea and notion of, you know, college is supposed to be the four best years of your life. And therefore, you should have a good time. It's almost like a country club. And in fact, Princeton University was started as a country club.
Are you serious?
That's an actual fact. You should look it up online. And email me if that's not true. We'll correct it. Ivy Leagues was just an athletic league of the, you know, countries in the Northeast that happened to also be a very wealthy private schools. And so the party pathway is actually the pathway for colleges where these affluent kids can get a job without really working hard at school. I mean, this is a harsh word, but that's how the like the book says it, where, you know, people with the family resources, the connections, they can put them in these schools. They can get their degrees, that label of, you know, these people are guaranteed or in some sense, like,
Right.
like examined as like productive members of society, and therefore you should hire them. So it's like almost a label, right? Or a prestige label.
It is. And it kind of, it just hurts. It in some ways hurts people who are poor more.
Exactly.
It's harder for them to get it.
Yeah.
Harder for them to move up. They don't, you know, they're not in the social circles and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So the people who are relatively poor or not as affluent, they are going through a different pathway in the same college. It's called the mobility pathway, where, you know, they are actually looking for vocational training. They actually need the skills to get the job that you want.
Right.
So,
yeah.
So they're trying to, like, actually get a job, and they have to put in the work and not party all day, things like that. And and this author was trying to show this through Greek life, pretty much. It's almost an attack on Greek life. And so it's, you know,
right.
So you can take it as with a grain of salt, but her argument was saying that, you know, because these affluent students don't have to really study, they can make these Greek life, you know, fraternities, sororities, they dominate the on-campus and off-campus social scene, right?
Yeah, totally.
Right. And meanwhile, these people who, like, actually have to get a vocational training, they are working their tails off and therefore cannot go to these Greeks like meetings, can't go to the parties. They're working hard.
Yeah.
And in some sense, that makes a stratification in the college.
Yes.
Yes. And yes. And so yes. It's interesting because, like, the people who are in the mobility pathway actually maybe produce that kind of, like, economic productive, you know, asset.
Yeah.
While
no one else, mm-hmm. no one else does. Yeah.
Right. Right.
Right. No, that's true. Yeah. Very true.
At the same time, the author's arguing, like, you know, the universities actually only allocate money for the affluent people.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Right.
The athletic facilities, you know, you look at state schools, even Hopkins, our stadiums are great. and like, you know, you look at all these, like, athletic facilities, all these Greek commitment. It's not as much in at Hopkins, but at some places, the Greek life, I guess, buildings are on campus. They're part of the campus real estate.
They
use that almost as a marketing strategy, saying, hey, we have all these attractions. You can play sports. You'll have a great time socially, so you should come to our college.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, that's what it is. Yeah, I think, great book. I think a lot of great points are made, mm-hmm. are made there.
Yeah.
Anyway, Joseph, I need to get going.
No worries.
Go on this run. Let's record another one tomorrow. Let's just do a different one.
Let's
scrap this one. This is a trial. let's do one tomorrow, okay?
All right, sounds good.
I think we got some good stuff, but, you know, like, I was a little bit fuzzy on my my knowledge of mm-hmm. Fukuyama, so I need to brush up on
that. No worries.
Okay.
Word. Yeah. All right, Kurt, thank you for being on the show.
We're not on the show. We're not on the show, Jess.
All right. See you tomorrow.
Right, I'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you for tuning in, and I'll see you next time.